Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. Today we have Tara Moore joining us. Tara is an expert on women's leadership and well-being. She is the author of the very successful book, Playing Big, Practical Wisdom for Women Who Want to Speak Up, Create, and Lead. It was named the best book of the year by Apple's iBooks, and it's from Penguin Random House. And I want to tell you guys, I checked out this book. It is packed solid with legitimate practical advice, stuff you can apply tomorrow. We walk through all the things that I thought were really cool, but honestly, it was really hard to pick because there were many, many, many insightful, practical, hands-on things you can do to play big, right? How to speak up. Why don't we lead and speak up from a big place within ourselves? Tara definitely brought it today. I know you're going to enjoy today's show. She has had her work featured on the Today Show, the New York Times, Goop, Harvard Business Review. She went to Stanford, Yale. This woman has had quite an education, but brings it down right to your everyday life to think about how to lead big, particularly for the women out there, for coaches, therapists, and managers who want to grow and have personal growth in your life. I hope you enjoy the show. I definitely learned a lot and very much found her content to be helpful in my life right away. Thanks again for listening and tune in to hear what Tara has to say. Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. Today we have Tara Moore here. Hey, how are you today?
I'm great. I'm great. So happy to be with you.
I am so happy to have you here. I really have to say, I don't always read the books. Sometimes, you know, the people have a message that it resonates, but I really loved reading your book. She's the author of Playing Big, Practical Wisdom for Women Who Want to Speak Up, Create, and Lead. Really, really such practical, tangible, detailed book about what to do specifically. So thank you so much for putting so much thought into it. Did you find that you just wanted to put everything on the table when you wrote this book? That was the sense that I got.
It did feel like it was a long time coming because the frustration with the lack of women's leadership and voice in our world had certainly been brewing in me for, you know, since childhood. And then so many years of seeing what we do as women from our conditioning that tends to get in our way and what we could do differently that I then started to discover through my courses and my coaching practice. So yeah, it felt like by the time the book came, there was an accumulated many years of a lot to say, which was good because it makes for a very organic and quick and sort of fluid writing process.
Yeah, it just, for everybody out there, if you want the kind of book that every page gives you actual answers and techniques, and like it wasn't one of these sort of concept, sort of theory-based books, right? Like, which I think people sometimes they enjoy, but it doesn't leave you much to do Monday morning. This was one of those books that I felt like, wow, each chapter I could like practice this.
Thank you. I'm so glad to hear that. And I'm always, you know, having a coaching background and doing this work with people, I feel such a responsibility. I'm kind of like, what is the rest of the world doing if they're not giving people those really practical in the moment? What do you do when you face fear or self-doubt? Like, what do you actually do? I feel like that's a responsibility of people who do this kind of work. But it's funny that you're, you know, mentioning the practical piece, because in the original printing, the first printing of the book and the hardcover version, the word practical wasn't in the subtitle. We had a different subtitle. And then after the first, you know, year of feedback, we just heard so many people saying that what this book is so practical and that's such a differentiator. And so and for that reason and a couple others, we gave it a new subtitle that has that word. So we do hear that from a lot of people. Yeah.
Because it really is. It's like it stands out. So on that note, I wanted to jump in on one of my absolute favorite topics, the inner critic, right? This show is all about authenticity, finding your true self, diving in. But when you do that, you're faced with that inner critic, you're right? Like you turn in and who's standing there, that voice, the one that judges and critiques. And you have all of this really cool discussion in your book about inner critic versus realistic thinking. Can you dive into why the inner critic isn't realistic and why you differentiate it in that way?
Right. Because this really comes up, especially for those of us who have been trained to be good critical thinkers. Maybe we use critical thinking skills a lot in our professional lives. We want to be realistic. And so when we start to look at this voice of the inner critic, like, well, what is that voice in me that says I'm not good enough, or that person would, you know, wouldn't want to date me or wouldn't want to be my friend, or I don't have what it takes to make that career transition into the field I would love to be in. Like, we start to notice that voice. And here there's someone like me saying that's your inner critic, and that, you know, and that's a irrational voice. And a very reasonable question arises, which is, how do you know that's an irrational voice? What if it's telling the truth? I mean, isn't it possible that I'm not ready to make that career transition? Isn't it possible that, you know, I really am not the kind of person that person I like would want to be friends with? Like, what about, right? We all have real deficits, and there's those kinds of realities. So it's really important to start to distinguish between the voice of the inner critic and realistic thinking. And the overarching idea about how you can make that distinction is that it's not so much a difference between what your inner critic says and what your realistic thinking says. It's a difference between the tone and the spirit that it says it in. So your realistic thinking might sound like, you know, I really don't know if I have the qualifications and the needed experience to make that career change. I wonder how I can find that out. Okay, let me do some research. Let me talk to a few people who made that change. And if I notice some gaps, I'm going to work as quickly as I can and as hard as I can and as much as possible in a friendly, nurturing spirit with myself to make up those gaps. That's very different than the inner critic, the kind of looping, repetitive, not searching for solutions, but just naming the problem over and over again, often anxious, fearful sounding voice of, you know, oh, but what? No, never mind. I don't have what that takes. Okay, let me dream about it a little more. And then the thought comes crashing in like, oh, but you could never pull that off. So there's a really different quality to the two voices in the tone. And in that sense of, is this voice then immediately going to help me find the solution to the problem that it's pointing out? Or is it just looping in the problem? Is it able to see the gray and the nuances here? Or is it telling me, you know, I'm totally going to be the best ever at this and I'm better than all these other people doing it, or I'm the worst? That's kind of a hallmark inner critic, egoic voice, very black and white thinking, whereas true realistic thinking is able to see the gray. And as you're kind of pointing to, one of the tricky things here is that we have confused realistic thinking with negative thinking in our culture. And so often when we're negative, we think we're being realistic, but real realistic thinking is very curious, very interested in finding facts and getting real evidence, not just ruminating in our heads, and very generative. It's actually very forward moving.
Yeah, I love that. And curious to me is always like such a critical piece of it, because when you can become curious about things that are going on with you instead of judgmental or anxious, like it's such a different headspace, right? When you're curious, you're interested, you're grounded, you're moving forward, you might feel a little trepidation, right? You might feel a little anxiety to do something new. That's okay, right? Like we get that little jolt of, I don't know, right? Like it's somewhere around anticipatorial, maybe a little fear, but yeah, that inner critic brings out a totally different voice. And I love how you say mean-spirited. The thing that really, really, really grabbed me was this one piece about how it, and I hear this from my clients all the time, I can't give up my inner critic because it motivates me.
Yes, this is a big one. And I started seeing, you know, as I started doing talks on the inner critic and how we can not let it play such a detrimental role in our life, there would always be a hand that would go up at some point in the presentation, and someone would say, you know, I am just not sold yet that I should let go of my inner critic. Don't you understand, Tara? You know, my inner critic is the reason that I got straight A's in college, because I went back and studied more because I thought I was going to fail every test. My inner critic is the reason that, you know, I stay on top of things in my job because I'm preparing harder than everyone else because I'm afraid I'm going to be asked a question in the meeting that I don't know the answer to. So that is a reality for many of us. And I would say that was true for me for much of my life as well. I was definitely that, you know, achiever who got scared before the night before, the day before, the week before, and in a very inner critic fueled way, did the extra preparing or rehearsing or whatever that then does work to some extent in the world and does get you some points and some successes. And so it's reinforced and we do it again.
Can I just pause there? Yeah. Because that's such a critical piece that I love that you pointed out, because most people are like, oh, don't be mean to yourself, or it's not good to be negative, but it really does work. And there's so many ambitious achievers who have used this and they have gotten the singular outcome of success, right? Like, I think that's such a fair thing to comment on, because so many people are like, how can you complain or give me a hard time about something which has a proven outcome?
Right.
Yeah.
And we know from some research that it's particularly true for women and people of color, because we need to be more competent than our white male peers in order to be seen as equally competent. And, you know, if you are a person of color or a woman, you didn't need a study to tell you that. You probably picked that up by the time you were in the third grade, if not earlier. And so even you can see in grade school, women and people of color are spending more time in preparatory tasks in the work world. They're doing more hours of preparation for meetings and so on. So there's a payoff to it that also has to do with bias. And it's a survival strategy in some ways around bias. The key is that we have to start seeing the ways that the effectiveness of that is actually limited and gets in our way of some things, even while it's helping us succeed at others. And what I mean by that is, first of all, you may have adopted that as an early strategy for success or survival, but think about how it feels to do your work from that place, right? In the place of, oh, I might totally screw this up. This is, you know, if I don't work extra hard, I'm going to be exposed as not having, right?
Yeah. And come on, some people, I mean, they would shudder to think if we played the real tape in their head out loud, right?
Like, right.
People are so mean to themselves. You know, I mean, the profanities and the negative bullying, really, that people might do inside their own heads.
Yes. So you don't want to be doing your work from that place. It's not fun. And when I ask people, you know, if you knew you could also do excellent work, not motivated from that place, but from a positive place of wanting to deliver incredible work, of wanting to be of service, of wanting to use your gifts, like, wouldn't you choose that? They always say yes. It's just realizing that that's a possibility. So that's one. What do you want your quality of life to be while you're doing the work? The second is, from a health perspective, to do your work from that inner critic fueled place means you've got stress hormones going through your body a lot. And the data is very, very clear that over time, that will cause chronic health problems. You can't work in a fear-fueled, stress-fueled state without that paying a price for your health. But the third cost, and really for me, this is the one that I feel the most passionate about and that I think is the most important for us to talk about, is that the inner critic only fuels you to do certain kinds of work that only achieve certain kinds of success. So the inner critic will help you go back and make sure, you know, did I dot all the I's and cross all the T's? The inner critic will say, go do more research so you're more prepared. The inner critic will say, you know, go get one more master's degree or one more certification in the topic. So you will, because it wants to feel a sense of control and thinks those things will give it a feeling of not being afraid or not being able to be called out. So it can send you to do all those kinds of work. And yet you can maybe be a little bit more perfectionistic, accurate, You might have more knowledge that you've mastered, but that inner critic voice is never, ever, ever, ever going to say, yeah, share your idea now. Yeah, ask that provocative question now. Take the stretch assignment now. Go meet with that influential person in your industry now. Launch your thing that you want to create in the world now. It's never going to help you do any of that. So it can take us to a certain level of, you know, our bosses can say we checked certain boxes or we can check certain boxes in our careers. But to get to the real kind of impact and the authentic impact that comes from who we each individually are, that most of us are longing for, and that know that that's what's going to bring us that deeper career fulfillment and that bigger career success, our inner critic can't help us do those things. And it actually will stop us again and again from doing those things.
Yeah. Yeah. Just great advice. I love it. And, you know, the health thing too, I mean, I know we went past that pretty quickly, but those stress hormones creating that inflammation does create more fatigue. Yes, long-term illnesses and things we could talk about, but you also don't have the same energy when you're in a state of inflammation. So it's actually causing you to feel worse and perform at a lower.
Don't have the same energy. And you certainly also don't have access to your best thinking, right? When you're in any kind of fight or flight type of state or stressed out state, your body thinks it's supposed to be prioritizing an emergency response measure with a lot of adrenaline, and it will shut down other less important functions in your body and in your thinking. So if your work requires you to be discerning, to be wise, to, you know, come up with novel answers and problem solving, you can't do that very well when your inner critic is active and motivating you.
I just think this is such great advice. And you also talk about this game of visualizing your future self, which I thought was really clever and fun. And I had never actually heard that one before. And I played the game. I have to admit, I was having a lot of fun with it. But visualizing your future self out 20 years and how that kind of can help organize your future planning. Can you talk a little bit about what that visualization technique is and how people might benefit from it?
Yes. So this is a tool that I first encountered in my coaching training, which I did at the Coaches Training Institute, CTI, which is a phenomenal organization. And at the time, a really important piece of their curriculum was this future self work. And they developed a visualization. It takes about 20 minutes to do. Close your eyes, get relaxed, get out of your everyday thinking and into a more open and sort of what I would call a more right brain, intuitive, visually driven place, and do this sort of guided meditation that takes you to meet yourself about 20 years in the future. Now, a lot of times people have an immediate inner critic reaction just hearing that. So I want to call that out. Like if you're saying, I'm not a visualization person, or that wouldn't work for me, guess what? You're hearing your inner critic. And I refer you back to the inner critic chapter of Playing Big. It's funny. We actually, the reason the inner critic chapter is first in the Playing Big book is because it's hard to really embrace any of the other tools if you don't know how to quiet your inner critic's commentary about
that. If you can't turn inwards, that's why the word curious is one that really helped me and I use all the time for my clients. But if you can't turn inward and look without getting consumed by the inner critic, you kind of can't start. So it's really important to learn how to interact with that critic in a nice way.
Yes. And there's nothing wrong with you if your inner critic is speaking. It's not that you're bad or inexperienced. We all have that voice come up when we start to turn inward because the egoic part of us finds that a little scary that we're turning inward, and it's going to try and get us to go turn outward again. And so that's all that inner critic chatter is just trying to steer you away. So that it's totally normal, and it's good to have tools to deal with it. So the inner critic, the inner mentor visualization, the future self visualization that we're talking about really does work for everybody in one form or another. I've, you know, seen that now with thousands of people. But from the first time I experienced it in my coaching training, what really shocked me was here, we did this 20-minute visualization. I was doing it for the first time, you know, then with the group. And as people shared about this future self that they had met through the visualization, I saw, you know, 50-year-old men weeping about it that hadn't cried in a long time. I saw, you know, people one after the other just so incredibly calmed and moved by what they saw. And it was very clear that something quite mysterious and remarkable was happening in the visualization, where people weren't just meeting like their projection and hope of who they thought they would turn into in 20 years. In other words, if I had asked them, you know, asked that same guy, 50-year-old man, before the visualization, like, so where do you hope you'll be in 20 years? Well, you know, I hope by then I'll have this much in my retirement account and my business will be doing this well. And I hope I'll stay in shape. And, you know, I'm planning to still be happily married by then. And my kids are going to be successful. All the more personality driven and in a way very limited consciousness hopes about what would happen. Well, that, what I just sort of ran off there, was completely different from what this man experienced. And that was true for everyone in the room, that the figure that they met in the visualization was sort of an older self, but almost more a authentic self, like a representation of their true self, a representation of the older, wiser voice within them, kind of the crone voice or the elder voice, and just had very remarkable and surprising and healing things to say and to share. And in the visualization,
I mean, just to put a pin in that one point, when I did this very briefly without a 20-minute experience, I just kind of closed my eyes and gave it some thought. I had that experience right away and it really surprised me. I was like, oh my God, that's not what I would have said at all. I did not have that vision of myself at all. And I conjured up this really great version of myself. And I was so happy with what I had to say and how I appeared, everything. It was really, and I'm not usually a huge visualizer. So that was really fun.
Yeah. And can you share a little more about, if you're comfortable, what you saw or what was different than maybe what you're sort of conscious, regular thinking projection would have been?
If you asked me that question, to your point about like 401ks and all that stuff, right? Like if you just said to me, hey, Laura, in 20 years, what would you visualize? And I'm just answering you without thinking, you know, or relaxing into it, I would be very practical. I would think about, okay, well, my son's off in college, and it would be analytic, right? My son's in college and I've retired maybe to New York and living in a small apartment, and I could say what I wanted to say about my future. But when I did this technique, it was like this warm, inviting version of myself who seemed at peace. And like, it was back in New York, which was fun. But the outfit was very aligned with how I am most happy in the way that I dress. The person was very relaxed and encouraging of what I'm doing right now and to keep it up and not to sweat the small stuff and it'll all work out. And it was just a very relaxed and positive thing, not very practical and filled with sort of the logistics of it all.
Yeah, exactly. So that tone and of warmth, of greeting you, the younger you, in a loving way, the sort of visual where you know the meaning or what the visuals kind of stand for, and it's very evocative.
Yes,
that's the experience people have. And then what's so incredibly powerful is we can then really draw on that figure like a mentor. And that's so in the playing big model, we call this inner mentor. And a lot of the work I've done sort of now taking forward that foundational exercise is about really expanding women's ability to relate to that figure like a mentor. And this, of course, works completely for men too. It's just that my work has happened to be more with women. So that then, and we could actually do this right now, Laura, if you want to, if you think of a situation in your life right now that feels difficult or upsetting or a dilemma where you're not sure what to do, you can close your eyes for a minute and check in with what your inner mentor has to say about it.
Okay. So I'm thinking about my second book and I'm trying to decide, you know, the logistics of what I'm doing with it. It's so funny. I go right back to the same image and the same place. Mm-hmm. And this person is telling me right away that the thing that's on my mind that's concerning me is the small stuff, not to sweat that.
That's not what to worry about.
It's about writing this book. The rest of it is not an issue.
Great. And anything else she wants, if you go back to her just for a moment and close your eyes, anything else she wants to tell you or anything else around that?
Like, you're on the right track. This is what you should be doing. Don't even think about it. Right. I'm thinking about self-publishing, or if I'm going with a publishing house this time, because I self-published last time, that's what's on my mind right now. And this person's sort of smiling and laughing, like, that's the least of your worries. Like, just go forward, write the book. You know what you want to say. It'll be great. Very encouraging, very warm, and surprising, right? Like, for those people listening, this is like some strange maternal version of myself that I don't think I've really ever been in contact with. So that's fun.
Beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. And what's so great is, you know, if you were to, I don't know, just ask the question on a, you know, on a writer's forum, like, you know, should I self-publish or blah, 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 like, and someone were to answer back to you, like, don't worry, you know, it's all going to be great. Like, you would be like, hello, that's right. I have my dilemma. So what's so amazing about our inner mentors, and I think we can all hear this in your voice, is it's a felt experience, right? And so when she's saying that's the small stuff, you can actually feel a truth of that.
This feels so honest and true and real to me. It's like, yeah, it's a perspective that, like, at 46, if I think back to my 20-year-old self, there's things I'd like to say, and it feels like that. Like, it's just this very clarifying, but trustworthy kind of source.
Yeah, exactly. So thanks for jumping in with that beautiful example. So that, you know, over the years, I have seen this just again and again and again and again. And even, you know, just this weekend, we got an email from a woman who had taken the Playing Big course a few years ago and was just facing a really tough interpersonal situation in her career, and kind of had been felt quite betrayed by someone she works with, and saying, you know, what do I do in this situation? And we just reminded her about the inner mentor tool and how she could kind of quickly go back and check in with her inner mentor about it. And her inner mentor, you know, had, of course, a totally different perspective on the situation that she did. Some symbolism came into the check-in where the inner mentor sort of showed up with a certain image of an animal for her and a gift. And then she was able to look at the symbolism of that animal and understood how that related to the situation. So it's just, it's so powerful, and it's always available to us. And from a perspective of playing bigger, you know, it's just kind of how I frame this central journey here that we're talking about in my work. What we're really talking about, it's not the world's definition of playing bigger. Oh, I'm going to get the corner office and, you know, I'm going to be at the top of the pyramid. It's playing bigger in the art of authenticity, playing bigger in stepping into the life and work you feel called toward. And the inner mentor is one of the most, if not the most powerful tools for that, because it is your authentic self. It is a more self-actualized you that you can connect with and that you can get a sense of. And then you can say with every decision in your life, you know, what would he do? What would she do? What's she saying about this? How would she approach this situation? And by doing that moment by moment, situation by situation, you grow more into that person. And that's what, you know, that's what I think self-actualization, playing big, authenticity, that's what it really means. It's not just bigger and it's not just authentic. It's growing into the core, essential, soulful part of ourselves, the highest self that we want to express more and more in the world.
To everybody listening, I'm telling you, like, check out this book, try this visualization, because I don't want to sound corny and say, because I have the podcast Art of Authenticity, this really feels like the most authentic part of myself. But now that you brought it up, I'll fess up. I mean, it really does feel that way. It feels like the fastest way to access that authentic voice. You know, I practice all sorts of techniques to tap into my truth all day long, because this is something that I'm obviously passionate about. But that was just an extraordinary visualization that, having you walk me back through it right now, it's now, it's so accessible, right? And it's so easy to keep coming back to.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
So on a sort of opposite note then, right, this authentic visualization of oneself and the things that get in the way, you brought up a sort of larger chapter around undermining speech habits, which I was like, wow, guilty, guilty, guilty. Like, I think I do all of them. And I think I do all of, so there's a whole bunch of speech habits for those of you who haven't read the book, like putting, you know, does this make sense? Or using the word just too often to make it more palatable. And I guess I wonder about that line between being blunt and masculine versus, you know, transitioning sentences that are, you know, softer. I think you did cover very nicely how to avoid these types of undermining turns of phrase without becoming blunt and coarse. Why did you make this a section of the book, first of all? Why is this so important? And secondly, what do you think about that line between overly hedging and being too forthright?
Right. So I included this part in the book for a couple reasons. One is that for a lot of us, these speech habits are just totally unconscious, but they really are affecting how we come across. So in our culture, there is a certain way that women tend to get socialized to communicate, the way we absorb, hear, you know, what we absorb in other women as we hear them communicate, what feels comfortable to us. And that tends to be a way of communicating that has a lot of phrases and words that qualify and shrink what we have to say. So, you know, I just want to ask a question instead of, I want to ask a question. I actually disagree instead of, oh, I disagree. Did that make sense? Implying I said something crazy. You know, I'm not an expert in this, but I want to, da, da, da. I know you've all been thinking about this longer than I have, but there's also things we do with our voice, like raising our pitch at the end of a sentence, which makes a sentence sound like a question and gives it a questioning tone instead of a declarative one. And the research shows that, yes, when we talk with all of those insertions and qualifiers, we come across as less authoritative. We come across as less confident. It also shows, and I always now share this because some people will say, well, men say those things too. There are studies that show men can use, first of all, they don't use them as much, and not just men, but people with higher status do not use those things as much. People with lower status, for various reasons in our culture, you know, in simulations where status is assigned, they use those qualifiers less because people with low status have learned to do them to find a way to get their voice into the conversation, right, without being too threatening. So we do use them more. And to the extent that people with high status do them, when they use them, they aren't read or interpreted in the same way. In other words, a man can say, you know, a white man in a business meeting can say, you know, I'm not the expert on this, but here's what I think. And everyone would say, you know, isn't he a collaborative, right? Like leader, where he's acknowledging that there's someone else in the room had the expertise. That was so lovely. And it really might be lovely, right? Because he might need to do that to not sort of take away someone else's power or voice in the situation, especially if he's the one in a leadership role. But if a junior woman says, you know, I know you all know more about this than I do, but da 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 da, that's going to be read as her lacking confidence or as reinforcing, right, an existing perception that she doesn't have the expertise. So we're using these, and it can be very helpful to become aware of them and then start to let them go. And we do that, you know, in everything in the book that I talk about that women do that gets in our way. I think this is really important to say. We do all of it for very sound, understandable reasons. Like, this is how we have learned to survive. This is what is being handed down to us from women who had to be even more constrictive of themselves to survive and function in the society. We have, I think we all carry, you know, PTSD from the history of violence against oppression of exclusion of women, and we're all trying to find our way out of the fear from that and the work and be in the process of recovery from that, we're all learning how to be here now that we have a little bit more freedom here. And so that shows up in our speech. And as we work to let go of it, we can, you know, we can do it with a lot of compassion for ourselves of how it got there in the first place, not with blame. So it is important in terms of communicating more powerfully. I also included it in the book, frankly, because over the prior years of writing and speaking and teaching about these issues, I did find that for some women, this communication piece is like a really fun entry point for them into the whole bigger journey of how they might be being run by fear or inner critic or of getting in their own way. And so because it's very practical and they can actually look in their emails and be like, oh my gosh, I just put, you know, 20 extra of those things in this email. It's just, it's very tangible and it has a kind of lightness to it that some of the other topics we cover don't. So I always like to have it in the mix for that reason. And then as you're saying, there's this whole other issue of, well, then what if I take out all of these qualifiers? Am I going to sound mean? Am I going to sound bitchy? Am I going to sound too aggressive? Am I going to sound like a man? And the first thing to notice is that, you know, wow, look at how we've been conditioned as women to think if we take out words like just and actually, and, you know, I'm no expert, that brings up the fear for us of sounding too aggressive, to just say what we think and feel. And that's sad. And it's not, you know, it's not crazy, because often women do get called those things when they take out the qualifiers. So then we can look at, okay, how do I convey warmth? And how do I convey the kind of relational focus and the caring about others that I want to convey? How do I keep all those things in the mix, but not with these kinds of speech habits that diminish my competence?
Yeah.
I'll give one quick example and then I know the lot here. So instead of saying, you know, I'm feeling like we're taking the wrong strategy in this company and da 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 da, did that make sense? Right? Which we're doing partly to connect with our audience and partly to show we want to know we're connected and we care what they think. Instead of saying that, we say, I think we maybe are pursuing the wrong strategy and blah, 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 blah. You know, what does everyone else think? I'd really love to hear your thoughts.
Yes. And you're making me feel very full circle here, because we started with the inner critic and realistic thinking. And when you gave the example of the male who is running the meeting and says something like, I'm not the expert, but, and I ran a company, and I would say that in a company environment when in fact I'm not the expert. Like this. And so maybe two, is it fair to say, don't do it to be, you know, putting yourself in a diminished position, but in fact, if you're not the expert and that's just realistic, then it's okay to say, hey, I'm not the expert. Here's an idea. What do you guys think? Because in fact, they are the expert, right?
My question would be, what's the benefit of saying I'm not the expert, as opposed to saying, you know, here's the question I'm having, or here's the thought that's coming up for me. Sarah, I know this is the area you've been looking at for a long time. What are your thoughts?
If Sarah's just been looking at it for a long time, I agree. But if you're standing in a room with somebody who has a PhD in, you know, biomechanics, for example, and you're asking a question specifically about that, I think there is a time and a place where that makes, so just back to that realistic thinking, if you just really are in that realistic situation, it makes sense. But to do it for the sake of doing it, it's just.
Yeah. And I still would push on, you know, what's the need to say it? Like, why say it? You know, you're not the expert. Other people know they're not the expert, but there's some reason you're in the conversation. And you're also taking us a little bit to another part of the book where we talk about the overvaluing of expertise that women in particular, I think, have been tricked into. And, you know, for people listening, like, you know, I believe very strongly in, you know, education. I have a whole background of traditional school behind me. I think it's great that we have domains of knowledge in every field. I am all for people getting their PhD and becoming experts in them. And I think on every topic, the expert has a role to play, and the non-experts have an equally vital role to play on the same topic. And what I mean by that is, if the person with the PhD in the room that you're just referring to, and let's say the topic is, you know, astrophysics, okay, that person is going to know a lot more about astrophysics than you and the latest, you know, what the latest scientific edge that we're on and all of that. And that person is also going to be very, very steeped in the culture of the field, the vocabulary of the field, the politics of the field, the biases and assumptions and blind spots of the field in a way that an outsider will not be. And we also have to remember that the canon of knowledge in almost every field is a male created one, developed the overarching paradigms and the foundation of knowledge are in almost every field developed in a time where women were completely absent from the field. And now women may be entering the field, but still operating in that paradigm. So women in particular often have a very different way of looking at things or are asking a different set of questions than the experts might be, male and female experts. And I think it's really important that we listen to our voices there and bring them forward and know we can bring something actually valuable that it can be hard for experts
Absolutely.
To bring.
And without question, cowering down, couching, being concerned just because somebody has an expertise is not the goal. And I guess I was just saying, if you gave the person that title and in fact they are an expert and you don't feel bad about it and you don't feel uncomfortable, then in that case, it's just maybe a side note. But I definitely hear you on that. As we wrap up to the end of the show here, one question that I ask everybody, and I'd love to get your opinion, as we talked about the inner critic and all these different ideas about what allows us to play big, what holds us back, what then do you think creates an authentic life? What does that mean to you?
To me, that means I am listening inward to my own desires and dreams and longings, and particularly those that feel a little scary to me because they require some courage. Probably they are things that my friends and family might not totally get or validate, but there's some individual inside of me call towards them or pull towards them. And living an authentic life, the blessing and the gift that I've discovered both in trying to live my own authentic life and then helping others do this is that the blessing and the gift is that to live an authentic life doesn't depend on bringing all those dreams into reality. Meaning, like for myself, if it feels like living an authentic life is expressing myself creatively through writing and all different media and reaching lots of people, you know, I'm thinking back to a time 10 years ago when those longings started to be really strong and I was willing to look at them. What I found was that I didn't have to wait until those things came true to feel like I was living an authentic life and to feel the vitality and joy in my life again. All that vitality and joy came the minute I was able to accept that those dreams were there and say to myself, okay, honey, I'll stop trying to talk you out of them. We'll work on this together and somehow we'll figure it out. And then to take some first little step, like just sitting down and writing something at my computer or publishing a first blog post that went to nobody, that exploded That's everything. Awesome. So it's a stance. It's not the realizing the outside outcome. It's the stance of how are you listening to your own dreams and giving yourself permission to go for them.
I love it. I love it. Thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing all of your ideas and thoughts and your new book. If people are interested in hearing more about you or purchasing your book, where can they find you?
Yeah. So the book is pretty much everywhere. If you want to get the book, it's probably easiest to go to wherever you like to buy books, Amazon or your local bookstore or wherever you'd like to do that. And then my website is at taramoore.com. And there are lots of great free resources there. You can get the 10 Rules for Brilliant Women workbook if you want to sign up for that. That's a free download, and lots of goodies there. So I'm happy to connect with people there as well. And I guess people now, it's all about the other thing. So I am on Facebook and Instagram, Tara Moore, and Tara Sophia Moore on
Instagram.
Awesome.
So it's Playing Big, yeah. Guys. Practical wisdom for women who want to speak up, create, and lead. And her last name is spelled M-O-H-R, just in case you're checking her out right now. Thank you so much for coming on today's episode and again, sharing with our audience.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And thanks to everyone who's listening.